My name is Jessica Refakis, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Jessica.
Been sober since March 13, 1996. I would like to thank Tim for asking me to come and do this. It is, or was, short notice, but it's kind of funny, the story behind it. I don't know if all of you have heard or not, but I guess your other speaker was on the way here, and because of a expired license or something, she got pulled over and ended up in jail. And, you know, I can identify with that, you know. I actually was, as I was sitting there, I started thinking, is my car registered? Okay, it expired. Okay, I got to get it registered. But, you know, when I came here, I didn't have that. I didn't even know you had to get your car inspected. You know, that's just how I lived. I didn't live by rules. I just did what I wanted to do when I wanted to do it. Welcome to all the newcomers. It's great. You guys have so many here. I mean, that's just wonderful. You know, that is the lifeblood of AA, and I hope you guys stay, and I don't know if you'll get anything out of my talk tonight. I heard a lot of you guys talking about your book study, and I'm kind of on a spiritual high, too. My grand sponsor came into town last weekend and talked at my group's one-year anniversary, and she came from Norman, Oklahoma, and, you know, she's got a lot of stuff going on in her life, and she's been sober 19 years, and, you know, she just suits up and shows up, and she and, you know, the women she sponsors, my sponsor, that's what I've learned in here, you know, no matter what, suit up and show up, because I need that protection against the next drink, because I don't know when that thought's going to kick in, but I can guarantee you if I don't suit up and show up, it's going to kick in, and it's going to kick in awfully fast. Well, I guess I should start at the beginning. I was born in Latrobe, Pennsylvania, and that's where they brew Rolling Rock beer, and I like to think it was in the hospital, and I probably had some, you know, on my way out. I didn't live in Pennsylvania very long. My mom had married a man who was 20 years older than she, and he had four children from a prior marriage, and their biological mother had died, and so he married my mom, and they had me, and, you know, I don't remember really anything about him except that he was one of my first resentments. My dad died when he was 40, and, you know, I didn't know I had a resentment back then, but I can remember being a little girl and just, you know, crying over that and, you know, full of self-pity and mad at God that, you know, he would take my dad away, and my mom got remarried, but I still just, I felt so much anger towards that, and I just felt different, you know, and I've heard a lot of people talk from behind this podium, and, you know, my story is really mild in comparison to a lot of childhoods that people went through, and so my mom, when they got divorced, she moved to Ohio, and she remarried a man who adopted me. My biological dad died, and my dad adopted me, and, you know, I had a good childhood. I really did. We lived in Cleveland, and I just remember, you know, the snow and the seasons changing, and going to a Catholic school, I didn't like that very well. I didn't do very well, apparently, even back then. One of my grade cards, I got a hold of it one time, and it said, does not work well with others. You know, there I was, off in the corner, by myself. It's all about me. And, you know, but they decided to move when I was in the second grade to a suburb called Olmsted Falls, and my parents still live in that house today, and they never had any more children. That they just, I guess, made that decision, and so I grew up this only child, and my dad adopted me, and you know, I moved to that town, and it is such a beautiful little town. You know, it has the white picket fences and the river running through the middle of town, and you know, it was safe to go outside and ride your bike and play and do all those things. But even from an early age, I just had those feelings of difference. You know, like I'm just different from you. I don't know why or how, but I am, and I needed a drink, but I didn't have any. I went to spend a lot of time with my grandparents, and I just adored my grandfather. He probably could have qualified for this program. I remember we would go out on Saturday mornings, and he would, you know, be told by my grandmother, you need to go to the grocery store, and we would wind up at this bar. And I can remember walking into that bar, and they had the black floor mats, and there was a football game on the TV, and he would sit me up on that bar stool and get me a Shirley Temple, and he would order like a Jack and a Coke, and I just loved that, you know, and all the old men were around, and they're, and I just like, oh, I have arrived, you know, and I was probably the only little girl in there, but I just loved it. I felt so at home, and when I started drinking, I loved bars. You know, I loved the excitement and until the end, you know, where, you know, people just didn't really want to be around me. But I was the kind of girl that, you know, it's like I think of Where's Waldo? It's like, where's Jessica? You know, once, you know, you get any booze into my system, you never know where I'll end up. And that's just how I like to drink. But anyways, I went to school and I would do okay in school. If I didn't do okay, I would cheat. I actually got honest about that in sobriety. You know, I had good grades, but I cheated a lot of the times. It was like, where's the smart kid? I want to sit next to him and, you know, copy the answers and that kind of stuff. And I had girlfriends, but I was very catty and, you know, just full of fear that, you know, if I don't say the right thing or look the right way, you're not going to like me. And I would talk, you know, sweetly to your face and talk badly about you behind your back. And that's just the kind of person I was. And my parents, you know, they tried to do the best with me that they could. And I know that today. You know, when I got here, I thought it's all their fault. It's, you know, everybody on my four-step, it's all your fault. That's why I'm alcoholic. But I know today I'm alcoholic because when I drink, you know, the magic happens. And so I got some religious background, and like I said, I was mad at God from an early age. And by the time I was in the eighth grade, I can remember my mom, you know, asking me, do you want to make your confirmation? And by this time, I haven't had a drink, but I knew enough about God that, you know, and I was supposed to act a certain way. I was supposed to have certain morals. And well, I had already been doing things that weren't very moral. And, you know, if I wasn't doing them, I was thinking about doing them. And so she asked me if I wanted to do that. And, you know, I vividly remember that day, you know, thinking to myself, you know, well, if there is a God, you know, I'll meet him at the end of the road. And, you know, I'll have to make my amends to him when that happens. And I'm so glad that we get a chance to redo that in this program. You know, we get a chance to have a new relationship with God as we understand him. And you know, so let me give you a little snapshot. You know, in eighth grade, that's where I am, and I'm involved in everything. I'm in cheerleading. I'm in student council. I'm in choir. I'm in da-da-da-da, you name it. And I get straight A's, and, you know, I go to that science class, and I can remember being in science class and reading about the different things that people do. Well, there was alcohol. That didn't seem so bad because, you know, my family drank a lot. I was kind of used to seeing that around. But then there were those drugs, and, ooh, I'll never do those drugs. And, you know, so if you could have interviewed me, I guess, at that time, you would have thought, this girl might succeed. You know, she might make something of herself. And that's what everybody hoped for, and that's what they wanted. But, you know, my life was about to change because I was going to discover booze and discover what it could do for me. And when I was a freshman in high school, my girlfriend and I, we were dating senior boys. You know, now I think that's illegal, but, you know, that's what we were doing. We were 14 and they were 18. And we went over to my friend's house, and her mom was a single mom. And we had a six-pack of beer, and I called my mom that night. My mom, she worked at the police station, and she's a German-Irish woman, and she just, you know, you don't break the rules, you know. And one of the things she told me is, no matter what you do, just be honest. Just be honest. And I got on the phone that night, and I was to tell, you know, the first lie that I can remember. I know I told more, you know, some prior to this. I wasn't ever honest. But, you know, I told my mom that her mom was home because here I was with those boys and, you know, boys and booze, kind of my story. But she said, okay. And I got off of that phone, and I had had a beer already. And, you know, what I realized is that when I tell a lie and somebody else believes it, it no longer is a lie in my mind. And and that's how I would continue to act. And, you know, the magic didn't happen for me right that night. I had two beers. I don't know what kind of beer it was. But, you know, I remember I felt giddy and kind of, you know, like, oh, this is fun. I want to do this again. And so I did. And I was a social drinker for probably, you know, a couple of months until I discovered how to really drink. And I had graduated, well, the guys we were dating had graduated, and so I moved on to another boy, and this guy was 16, and I remember driving around in his red Volkswagen Rabbit, and we would go to the Quick Mart, and he didn't really look old enough to buy a beer yet, so we would sit outside and wait for somebody desperate enough to buy us booze to come by, and we would drive around on those cold winter nights in Cleveland and drink booze and, you know, have friends with us, and I started to get drunk, and that's when the magic happened, you know, because all of a sudden, it didn't matter that I felt less than you. It didn't matter that, You know, I always wanted to have blonde hair and blue eyes. It didn't matter that I didn't have that. It didn't matter that I always wanted to be wealthy and my parents were, you know, blue collar working family. None of that stuff mattered because the booze hit me and all of a sudden my outlook on life changed. And so we just would continue to do that. And I would chase that feeling and, was still trying to maintain that image in school. And I started to have what the book talks about, you know, that Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde image. And, I would like segregate my groups of friends. Like I would have my cheerleading friends and I would have like my kind of stoner friends. And then I'd have my kind of dorky friends. The dorky friends didn't drink, but you know, and I would just go and try to be, you know, that individual within those groups. And, I started to learn how to catch a buzz and, you know, I drank to get drunk and I didn't know about the phenomenon of craving. You know, I didn't know that whenever I would consume alcohol, I would want more. But I vividly remember being with girlfriends and we had a six pack of beer and, you know, divide that between three of us. That's only two apiece. And I said, no, I don't even want to start. What's the point? I'm not going to finish. And, you know, I didn't know I was an alcoholic, but that's how, I thought. And, you know, I wasn't a picky drinker. I drank wine coolers. I drank beer. I drank hard liquor. I did learn how to drink faster. You know, we got bongs, beer bongs. And, it was always a mystery by the weekend. Where's the beer bong? Is it behind the bushes? Is it in your car? Where's the beer bong? And, you know, I remember after one of those beer bong episodes, we were at an outdoor party around, you know, a bonfire and I remember going back to my car and waking up, coming to, because I passed out in my car after bonging, you know, I don't know, six, eight beers, I don't know. And just waking up and, you know, everything's kind of spinning around, but I got my bearings and, you know, it wasn't that bad. I could go and do more, so I'd go and do more. And so I just, I started to drink to get drunk every time. And, you know, it didn't matter that I wouldn't come home at night. It didn't matter that my grades started slipping. None of that really mattered to me. I just wanted to go to the next party. At this point in time, I tried to control and enjoy my drinking. Summertime was coming up, and I needed to go on a diet. So I stopped drinking for 3 months prior to my 16th birthday. And I can remember just white-knuckling it, you know, just, oh, God, you people are drinking. Oh, I hate you. You know, I'm not going to drink. And, you know, it was just painful. It was just agony to try to do that. And I got a phone call at the end of that little period of sobriety from a boy. And he had cheated on me, and my heart was broken. And, you know, I did the next logical thing. I got drunk, you know, practically every day that summer. And I learned quickly how convenient it is to have a car. I don't know if any of you have slept in your car, but when I was 16, my parents gave me a Dodge Aries K car. Yes, beautiful. And so we would just drive to the party. Now, my mom worked at the police station, so it was not cool to drink and drive. I knew that much. So I would just stay at the parties all night and, you know, say I'm sleeping over at somebody's house and sleep in my car. And I can remember the sun coming up and that kind of cottony taste in your mouth and, you know, just wondering, oh, what did I do last night? And it was kind of a joke. My best friend, who probably qualifies for the Al-Anon program, you know, I would tell her, could you fill in the blanks? That's what I called it. Those were my blackouts. Could you fill in the blank? What happened between the kitchen table and the living room? You know, that period of time between 2 and 3 in the morning. And she would tell me and I'd laugh. And, you know, I wasn't having a lot of consequences yet, but my school, you know, did suffer, and I started to feel depressed. And I don't know if any of you have ever felt depressed, but I started to feel depressed and started to seek out outside help. And so I went to my town's library and, you know, made sure no one was looking and went to the self-help aisle and got the books down by Louise Hayes or somebody like that. I don't know, one of those Nouveau people with the rainbow cover, and took it home, and you know, it would say, I love myself, I am worthy, I am a good, and I just felt like dog doo-doo, you know, that did not help me, you know, I would just drink, that's what helped me, and my mom started to look at me and go, what's wrong with you? I don't know if any of you have ever heard that, but, you know, what's wrong with you? Why can't you just go to school? And she was working a lot during the day, so I would just write notes saying I had the doctor's appointment. You know, I can't tell you, this is horrible, but, you know, if any of you are out there and feel guilty for this, you'll understand. You know, I would, my grandmother has died. They're both still alive, but they've died probably 20 times because I would go to their funeral. That was my excuse, you know, to miss school or to miss a test or whatever. And, you know, I felt so guilty about that when I got here, and I got to clean that up with some living amends. But, you know, by the time I was a senior in high school, I had missed the most number of days you can miss without having to go back and retake school. And my mom had she said, "Do you want to go to Ohio State with your uncle?" My uncle was just a little bit older than me. And I said, "Well, sure, you know, I'll go check out college." And my mom had never been to college, and it was really her dream for me to go. And so I went down with my uncle, and it was a football weekend, and it was, you know, in autumn in Ohio, the leaves are out, you know, it was just crisp and wonderful. And we started out with kegs and eggs at 6 a.m. And that was on Saturday morning. And by, you know, 11 o'clock in the morning, I had to go back to the apartment and pass out. And then I got up, and I think we went to the football game. I remember some of it. And, you know, that night we went down to High Street, which is like Lower Greenville. And God, I loved it. I just loved it. They had Mean Mr. Mustards, and it was like, I love the dirty bars. I like the bars you have to go downstairs to get into. You know, they're not at street level. I like the ones you go down, because then I feel better. You know, there are people in there that are worse off than me. It makes me feel better. And I came home from that weekend, and my mom said, "Well, what do you think?" And I said, "I want to go there. I think that'll work." And she said, "Great." So I applied, and I got in, and I went, and I started the following fall. And I don't know about you guys, but I'm a great beginner. You know, this was, I guess, my first geographic, because I went from Cleveland to Columbus, which is about a two-hour drive. And I got there, and my parents, God, they were just so happy for me. And I never knew how much what I was about to do hurt my mom until I got to make amends to her. But I got to that school, and they have two towers. If you guys ever watch football, you'll see the Horseshoe Stadium, and then there are two towers by the stadium. And I lived in one of those towers on, like, the 22nd floor. That was my dorm. My parents got me there, and they unloaded my stuff, and I was going to go through Sorority Rush, and there are all these other kids and their parents and everything. And we got onto an elevator, and I met some girl who was going to do the same thing. And I just got so excited, and I just latched on to somebody else. You know, that's just what I did. I just took hostages, and now I got a new one. And she was going to go through Rush, and I got up to that floor and got off the elevator, and I didn't want my parents to come with me. That was dorky, you know. I wanted to be independent and on my own. So what I did that hurt my mom so much and my dad is, you know, I just told them, "You guys can leave now." You know, she wanted to come in and make up my bed and, you know, unpack my stuff. And I just said, "Adios." And you know, I could see that sadness and disgust in their eyes, you know, that we often see in people that we hurt. And you know, I got to make amends to my mom. And when I made amends to her, she said to me, you know, the only thing she ever wanted for me was to be safe and happy, you know, And I give her that tonight by being in a place that's well lit and that's safe. And generally I'm happy. I'm a little crazy tonight, but I'm generally happy. And so I started at Ohio State, and I did great. You know, I got a 3.6. I got my major. I got into the sorority. I partied, and I was juggling all this stuff. You know, I met the next him. And the big problem with this guy is he didn't drink. And that was kind of strange to me, but I thought, well, okay, I can maybe work around this somehow, and he was worth it. And so I proceeded to date this guy for 2.5 years, and you know, my drinking started to get out of control. And one of the things that happened during that time that when I got here made me think, well, maybe I'm not an alcoholic, is there were times that I would go maybe 3 weeks, maybe a month at most, without drinking because he was always around. When I got to you guys, Baxter B. was the first to point this out in the big book to me, and it was like a light bulb. You know, it says the great obsession of every abnormal drinker is that someday he may be able to control and enjoy his drinking. Well, you see, I could control it. I could white-knuckle it, but I hated that. You know, I hated those periods of sobriety when I couldn't drink. And so every chance I got, I would go out and get drunk. I just would binge drink And I'd do stuff like go to Grateful Dead concerts in the middle of the winter. And, you know, there's a blizzard and, you know, the Weather Channel saying, stay home, do not drive, and, you know, drive an hour and a half away and just get messed up. And you know, people wouldn't know where I was. And I started to do this thing where, You know, I'm so delusional. Even today I can be too. But back then I was very delusional about places that I chose to live. And this first place that I chose, and this really just kind of gives you a good picture of my drinking. It was a 400 square foot apartment with this high shag carpet and termites crawling out of the walls. And I thought, this is ideal. It's close to campus. This will be fine. And so I started, you know, doing that, and I started withdrawing from classes and taking the money and going to drink. And this guy and I got a dog, and I call him my little Al-Anon dog. And, you know, I was going to go save the whales at one point. You know, I was, oh, I love animals, and I still do today. But when I drink, all bets are off. You know, you never know where I'm going to end up, like I said. And we would keep, I would keep this dog in my apartment, you know, locked up. And, you know, when I'd let him out, he'd, you know, defecate on the floor. And it was just not a pretty sight. And I started waiting tables at this time, which was a very convenient job for an alcoholic because you have to drink during work. You have to drink after work. It's just such a stressful career. Please, being a mom is stressful. That's nothing. But, you know, I did that, and that was my excuse. And, you know, from that place, I moved to the next place. And this place was in an area called Victorian Village, which really is beautiful. They have all these old Victorian homes, and I'm living by myself. And I move into this place, and it's this big Victorian house that has four apartments in it. And I'm in the upper apartment, and I have a snapshot still today of my mom and I on the front porch, and I have my hand on my hip like, you know, I'm going to make it here. This place is going to work. And, you know, I moved into that place, and it was still under construction. And just by the grace of God, nothing ever happened to me. I would lie there in bed, you know, by myself, and there'd be construction workers coming in and out, and my dog would be in his cage, and, you know, oh, what time is it? Oh, God, I can't get up yet. And, you know, things are just getting worse. And at this point, the guy that I'm dating, he takes me to a meeting, and I don't know if it was an AA meeting or not, but there was a woman, well, his sister spoke from behind a podium, and the only thing I can remember from her story is that she was a hippie, and in the late 60s went to Turkey and smoked hash in dens, and I thought, oh, that's cool, I haven't done that yet. I mean, that's where I was, and so that relationship ended fairly quickly. And, you know, it's one of those amends where, God, I want to go back. I'm sober now. You know, I hurt this guy. I want to make it right. And my sponsor said, no, you know, he's probably happily off doing whatever. And, you know, thank God for sponsorship and that kind of guidance. And, so instead I got to write him a letter and tell him everything that I felt and did and said. And I went up to, see my sponsor, and we went to a park, and we got the letter, and we burned it. And the last piece of paper wouldn't burn. I'm like, burn, burn, darn it, burn. And it did. And, you know, but I got some relief that way without having to cause more harm. So I'm flunking out of Ohio State, and I'm living down the street from some nasty places. And the next guy walks into my life, happens to be my husband. And I said, you know, boys and booze, they're just my story. And this guy was from Texas, and I'd never been to Texas. And he drove up to pick me up on our first date in this jacked up Bronco. And he's not a very big man. And he kind of stepped out of the car, and I had to kind of leap into the car. And, you know, we got along great. You know, he liked to drink like I did. And he had Joni Mitchell on the radio. And we went to fancy places and drank bottles, fancy bottles of wine. And I felt like, you know, things were getting better. Things might improve. And so I had to leave school, though. And my mom and dad, you know, they gave me an ultimatum. They said, you know, come home to Cleveland and get a job or support yourself. And, well, the pressure's on. So, sure, I'm going to try the easier, softer way. So I go home and I live with mom and dad for a week and just realize, you know, I haven't lived there under their roof for so long, and it just felt, I felt too closed in, too many rules, too much pressure, and so I called Mike, and he went down to Nashville, Tennessee, and he was in school there, and I said, you know, can I come and live with you, and I did, and again, I was to break my parents' heart. You know, nobody, well, I shouldn't say nobody, but my parents didn't want me living with another man out of wedlock, but I did, and I went down there, and Mike was in school, and I waited tables. And, you know, again, I'm just romanticizing the whole thing, just delusional. And I'm thinking, oh, we just have this bohemian lifestyle. We have this shack of an apartment on the river in downtown Nashville and, you know, all the country music scene around us. And we have no furniture. We sleep in a sleeping bag for, I don't know, or 3-4 months. I can't remember. And one day we drive by the dumpster, and there's this piece of furniture in the dumpster. And we get a little closer, And we discover that it's a recliner, and it has kind of that polyester wagon wheel upholstery on it. It has some cigarette burns in it, and it smells like booze, and we think, this is perfect. So we take it, we put it in the center of our living room, and that's our furniture. And we take our, you know, we don't spend money on groceries, and we go, and we drink, and we party, and, you know, we just have a good time, and we go to the bars, and, you know, I don't know where he is, he doesn't know where I am, and at 2 a.m. we come back together and go, where else can we go drink? And, you know, that's how we live there. It was ugly. It was bad. There were months I didn't talk to my parents. I had no friends left. One of my friends from high school tried to keep in contact with me, but, you know, I always just kind of like, come here, love me, and then push you away. And I just finally pushed everybody away. There was a really stressful, several stressful times while I was in Nashville, whether it was money or personal reasons or whatever. I would call up my parents in Cleveland, and we would do this thing called the exchange. And if this isn't insanity and unmanageability, I don't know what is. My parents would drive down 4 hours from Cleveland to Cincinnati. Mike would drive me up from Nashville to Cincinnati 4 hours. They would meet. They would do the exchange. I would get into my parents' car, drive back up to Cleveland. 3 days later, I would call Mike and say, I don't want to be here. So he would drive back up from Nashville to Cincinnati. My parents would drive down from Cleveland. And we did this several times, you know, and it was just crazy. And so finally, you know, Mike, he gets into law school down here in Dallas, and I don't have anything better to do, so I moved to Dallas, and, you know, I guess it's my next geographic, and we get here, and I decide I'm going to re-enroll in school, and I do, again, I'm a great starter, and I do really well, and still waiting tables, and Mike's doing his thing, and, you know, I just don't have many friends. The best friend I have is one of the guys that I work with at the restaurant. He's kind of like a Hobbit-esque guy. He's kind of a short and stocky guy and just jovial and just a neat guy and neat at the time because he liked to drink like we did and do other things. And so we would, you know, spend time with him. By Christmas of that year of 95, I had tried to manage my drinking for a while, so I thought I deserved a well-deserved vacation. And we went out to Utah to visit Mike's family. God, the alcohol was on, you know, we just drank. And we got back from that and it just kicked in. That phenomenon of craving just really, really kicked in. And I said to Mike, well, come on, you know, I know school starts, but we can go down to the Barley House and just have $2 beers or, you know, come on, just let's go play pool. Let's do whatever. And so we would go down there and drink. And then school started and I kept drinking. And what happened was the last 3 months, you know, January, February, March of 96 were really, really bad months, you know, and I hope, you know, there's a woman here tonight, we were talking outside, you know, that relapse mode and just how bad it can get. And I hope that was my bottom. And, you know, if you're here tonight, whether it's your first time here, you're coming in again, you know, you don't ever have to feel that way again. It's really the truth, but you have to surrender and do everything, you know, do everything. Buy the whole package, not just some of it. Buy the whole package. So those 3 months were pretty miserable, you know. It was winter in Texas, and I remember one time Mike was sick, and we shared a car. Well, I say that. It was actually his car, but I drove it. And, you know, I went wherever, you know, again, where's Jessica? And he was sick and he had bronchitis and he was at the library and I was supposed to pick him up and I didn't. He had to walk home from the library to our apartment and I just wasn't coming home, you know, and I never really thought that I had contemplated suicide, but it occurred to me a couple years ago that I really had. You know, I didn't have a gun. I was too chicken to do pills or slip my wrists or anything, but I remember vividly being in this high-rise apartment and thinking, it looks pretty good. You know, it looks like an option, maybe just to end this all and end this pain, because the pain was so great inside. You know, I never want to forget that. And that's what I love about working with newcomers is that I remember that pain. I don't have to go there, you know, but I can go there for a minute and remember what it was like. And so in the end of February of 96, Mike, he came to me, and, you know, I came home, and I was just out on one of my binges. I'd been out for several days, and he was scared. You know, he was terrified. He didn't know where I was, and I got home, and I remember being in my flannel nightgown, and, you know, outcome, the bathrobe and the slippers, and, you know, there I was on the couch, and, you know, I looked haggled. I just looked tired. And I was tired of living the way I had been living. And he said to me, I think you need to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought, oh, I know I drink a lot and I have lots of problems, but I'm not an alcoholic. And I had the stereotypical image of what an alcoholic was. But, you know, at that moment in time, I was just willing. I was just willing. And so we went to a meeting. But before we went to that, I did try other options. And I tried to go to that resort in Arizona where you do yoga and drink smoothies and get facials and detox for a while. And but they wouldn't take my insurance. So, you know, AA was the last house on the block for me. And, you know, I don't see it so much anymore because there are so many, and I love treatment centers, and, you know, I've sponsored women from there. But the way I did it, you know, I just walked into AA. I walked down that hall at the Preston Group, and I just sat down. I got a cup of coffee. I remember what I wore. I was such a wreck. I was such a train wreck, so self-obsessed. And, you know, oh, I've got to look so important to go to AA because I don't want to look like an alcoholic. You know, now I dress up for different reasons, but then it was to, you know, impress you. And I remember sitting down, and the topic was sponsorship, and it was a newcomers meeting. And afterwards, you know, I shared something, who knows what, some babbling, you know, newcomer thing. And I got all these women came up to me, and they gave me their phone numbers, and I was too dumb not to give them mine. So I gave them my phone number, and this was March 1st of 96. And I had some more drinking to do. My sobriety date's the 13th, and I went out a couple more times, and one of those women called me, and thank God, you know, that's why I get people's phone numbers today, and that's why I call women, because that's what we do. We reach out our hands, and thank God she called me, and it was, you know, early in the morning. I'd been out the night before. I was hungover, and she said to me, she called, and I could tell she was, like, in the car listening to the radio on her cell phone. She's like, hi, how are you? And I'm like, oh, I'm just fine. Everything's fine. You know how we are. And she laughed like you guys just did and said, you know, why don't you get your big book and meet me at Starbucks? And I said yes. You know, I said yes. I got in the car and I went, and I still do that today most of the time. You know, I get in the car and I go, and I went to Starbucks and we started reading through the big book, and she told me to look for the similarities and not the differences. And I'm so glad she did, because I was like, who's this Bill guy and who's this Dr. Silkworth and da 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 da, and it's written. What year was it written? And you know, but I started to identify, you know, and you guys started, I started to know that I was alcoholic because you guys spoke my language. You know, you guys told me about the, I don't know who was talking about the racetrack, but the racetrack in your head and the committee. You know, I thought before I got to you guys that I was schizophrenic. I may still be. I don't know. The jury's out. But I thought, you know, there was something beyond alcoholism that was wrong with me. And I know today, you know, I'm alcoholic and I suffer from this disease that does, it gives you voices in your head, it, you know, tells you to go different places, it just is crazy, and that's why I need to be grounded with God and a sponsor. And so I started going through the book and working the steps with this woman. Now, I don't recommend my first sponsor experience to anybody, but it is my experience, so I'll share it with you. When I started, I had two sponsors, and I went to a pretty large group, so I would tell one girl some stuff and one girl another stuff. Well, it ended up the one girl finally took O'Doul's, or drank an O'Doul's, which does have some alcohol in it, and then eventually got drunk. And I tried to keep her as one of my sponsors for a little bit, and it just didn't work. When you have more time than your sponsor, it doesn't work very well. And so I had this other lady as my sponsor, and, you know, this is so goofy. I did my first fifth step over the telephone. You know, I would never do that with somebody I sponsor today, but I did that, and because I was just so ready to do it, and she agreed to it, so we did it, and I left off that, you know, one important thing, and that I wasn't going to tell anybody until I got to the grave, and I left that off, and I didn't see results. You know, life was good. I was sober. I was going to meetings, but things weren't changing. My relationships with my family, you know, I think, you know, people talk about kitchen AA or, you know, in your home, you know, look at how your home is. Look at how your relationships are with your family and your siblings and your husbands and wives. And that will really give you a good barometer of how your program was working. And, you know, at 5 months sobriety, my parents paid for me to go with them to Maui. And I was just so ungrateful and just such a little brat. And, you know, I was sober here 5 months, but I got there. And, you know, I can remember my mom telling me, you know, why don't you just go take a drink? You know, she knew. She knew that that might fix everything. And, you know, it's such an amazing deal if you commit yourself to this program, what can happen. Because, you know, when I call my mom today and I tell her things like, you know, I'm driving 5 hours to Oklahoma to go to a conference, she goes, oh, yeah, is that conference? Oh, I'm so happy. Did you have fun? Da, 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 da. And, you know, she's so supportive today. And because I think I have changed. I know I have because I've been told that by others. And so I was feeling goofy in about a year and a half sobriety. This girl walks up to me and she's got, you know, just a sparkle in her eye. And she tells me about this other group she's going to and how wonderful, you know, and committed and just how great it is. And so I go and I go there and, you know, people meet me. And the next time I go back, they remember my name. And I was just so impressed with that. You know, I didn't realize that, you know, when you have only a couple new faces, it's a little bit easier to remember somebody's name. But that impressed me. And so I went back and I got a new sponsor and I started working the steps. And, you know, I'm here to tell you that from day one, I started praying. You know, I started praying to God to help keep me sober because I had no other choices. But my God barometer was not that good. I remember being 3 months sober and doing something really stupid and not very sober-like and thinking, oh, thy will be done, thy will be done. So if you're newly sober and you think it's God's will, you might want to check it with your sponsor. Anyways, you know, this woman, she sponsored me and she took me through the steps in order. And I got to that fourth step and, you know, I wrote down everything. I just poured it out, just like the book talks about. And, you know, on the first fourth step I did, I didn't even see my part. I mean, it's in there. You know, there's a column. There's a fourth column. I didn't even see that. My sponsor had to go, oh, there's another column you forgot about. Ha ha. But so I got to see my part. And, you know, I remember just feeling so ready to do my fifth step. And, you know, I've had the honor of doing two fifth steps with girls that I sponsor in the last month. And I cannot tell you, you know, what a promise the book gives us that we will not regret our past nor wish to shut the door on it. And, you know, I got to share with those women things that happened to me that were just like things that happened to them. And, you know, just what a miracle that is, because they got to walk away from that just like I got to walk away from that fifth step not feeling different. Because, see, I told you guys all my life I just felt different. I didn't feel a part of. And so I did that fifth step, and it was honest and it was thorough. And I got a lot of relief from that. You know, I got to the amends step, and there were some serious amends I needed to make. You know, my mom and dad were big ones, and didn't get to make any amends to old boyfriends, darn it. But I got to make amends to my father-in-law, who we weren't married at my husband and I weren't married yet, but I got to make amends to him. And, you know, that was a tough one. He's a man who has been married to the same woman for 35 years, who has been successful, you know, financially as well as just socially with friends. And, you know, people just love him. And you know, I look at him and he just, he always has like the set of principles, which like that I never knew until I got here. You know, he's just always lived his life by them. And I remember the day that I made amends to him. We were out in Utah, and my sponsor always told me that, when, you know, God would give you the nudge when it was time to make amends, to be willing to make amends. And I knew what I was out to do and out to say. And, you know, all of my life, I don't know about you guys, but I can't tell you how many times I said, I'm sorry. You know, I'm sorry. And that just doesn't fit the bill. You know, what we've done is wrong. And my sponsor gave me the words to say to him. And anyways, one morning he was going to take out the two Labradors and walk them down the street. And I got that nudge. And I said, oh, God, not now. I'm not ready. I don't want to. But, you know, I just was willing, and I put on my snow boots, and we went out for a hike, and we got to the top of this snowy hill, and, you know, it was just beautiful. It was cold, and the sky was blue, and it was morning, and the sun was shining, and the dogs are, you know, running up and down this hill, and he's throwing the stick. And I looked at him, and I said, you know, Pete, you know, I was wrong for what I did, And I went on to explain things that I had done to cause him harm, and I asked for his forgiveness, and I asked, you know, what I could do to make it right. And he said, just take good care of Mike, you know. And he didn't ask for, I'm so glad, but he didn't ask for any of the money back, which he, you know, had given to me to help get me out of some scrapes. You know, I know not all amends go that way, but I'm kind of glad that one did, you know. But I owe that man, you know, I owe that man this. I owe that man coming to meetings. I owe that man taking good care of my husband. You know, we got married in sobriety. Mike and I had alcoholics at our wedding. We've, you know, had a baby in sobriety, and it's just an amazing deal, you know. And last night I got to pick up my chip, and I celebrated 8 years, but I wanted to wait for my sponsor and grand sponsor to come down, and they did. And, you know, there's something to be said about sticking with a sponsor and just having that person who knows you inside and out, you know, knows your character defects and can spot them, like, before they're even coming out of your mouth. It's like, oh, there's selfishness, oh, there's jealousy, you know. But it, you know, I'm still so self-absorbed. I got up to the podium last night and got my chip, and I said, when Carla asked me to sponsor her, which is wrong, Carla is my sponsor. I asked her to sponsor me, and, you know, and I didn't even realize it at the time. People told me later, they're like, well, you know why everybody was laughing? Well, this is why. I'm like, oh gosh, it never ends. But Mike actually told me that Clancy once made the same mistake with Chuck C, so I'm in good company, I guess. You know, but it, what a deal, you know, and just the last year in AA has just been amazing. You know, we started this new group, and somebody talked about it a little bit, Danny, I think. You know, on page 164, it talks about how God will show you how to create the fellowship you crave. And I don't know about you guys, but I didn't like hanging around in ho-hum bars and drinking establishments, so by God, I better have an exciting AA life. And, you know, we have that enthusiasm at our group like you guys have here, and it's just been amazing. It's been amazing to see this group take off and to form, and just what a gift to sponsor women. This last year, I don't know what happened. I don't know if it's, you know, just getting older, like physically getting older in sobriety, or actually getting older in sobriety, or what, but I've had a lot of women that have asked me to sponsor them, and I've just been extremely grateful for that. And, you know, to watch the light come in their eyes, that gives me more of a thrill today than anything. You know, there's one girl that I sponsor. When I met her, she was, you know, hunched over at a meeting, crying, schlumpy and sweats and no makeup. And, you know, now I see her and, like, her hair's done. And it's just, and I know that's not me. You know, that's just having her come and do what we do. And what a gift it is. You know, what a gift. And I'm so glad to be here tonight. And thanks again, Tim, for asking me to speak.